The Tom Woods Show, episode 1822.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. The way to the inner circle of the Tom Woods Show is by drinking Press House Coffee, the official coffee of the Tom Woods Show. Its unique and delicious blends are absolutely irresistible. Take 20% off your first order when you use promo code WOODS at PressHouseCoffee.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. David Stockman is back with us today. You know David now as a regular on the Tom Woods Show. He, of course, was director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan and was a U.S. congressman before that. He had a distinguished private sector career, and he has an amazing website, DavidStockmansContraCorner.com, where you're going to get commentary and data that you're just not going to find anywhere else, and certainly not with David's analysis. And recently, my inbox dinged, and it was an email from David sending me a column he had written about Biden and the COVID stimulus. And I said, do you want to come talk about this on the Tom Woods Show? So that's what we arranged. So we'll talk about that and some other things. David, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
All right. Well, we've got a whole lot to talk about. I was just telling you that I got to see the comedian Rob Schneider last night, and it really encouraged me that his 60-70% of his show that was against the lockdowns and the hysteria about the virus was so well received. People cheered like crazy, standing ovation. They cheered for Governor DeSantis when Schneider said, look, we wouldn't be here having this show if it weren't for your governor, so you should appreciate that. So it was a really, really great thing to see. So we're still, you know, we've got the masks and plenty of the crazies around here. And there are some, you know, the show was, quote, socially distanced, but it didn't have to be. DeSantis is not insisting on that. But at least I got to go to a comedy show, and I'm going to see live music in a couple of months. I have a lot of this stuff going on. Now, you meanwhile have a, I hope you don't mind if I disclose the states where you reside.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so you've been in Colorado and New York for some time. I guess Connecticut before that. But
right.
Geez, between those three, not a lot to choose in terms of the lockdown regime. What does the future hold for David Stockman?
Well, you know, I think we're kind of stuck in New York, but we're looking at Florida, actually, to have a second home or maybe a total escape. Because, you know, Colorado used to be a mixed state. It was so-called purple. It's turning totally blue. We're here in Aspen, and we're now in a red-coated lockdown. All the restaurants are closed, everything. Out here in the mountains where people are, you know, 100 yards apart when they come down the ski slopes. It's really crazy. But I think there's a silver lining in all of this, which relates to the audience reaction we were talking about last night. They have gone the virus patrol, as I call it, led by Dr. Fauci, and then through the government or the federal health bureaucracy, and then that obviously filtered down to the state governors and blue state mayors and public health departments all around the country who were empowered and basically sanctioned by what the Trump White House and the coronavirus task force said was the terrible nature of the problem and all of the drastic steps that were recommended. I mean, I've said over and over, on March 13, the world changed, March 13, 2020, when basically Trump capitulated, got bamboozled by the Fauci and the virus patrol, put out all these new guidelines, asked for the two-week shutdown, and we were off to the races from there. Now, he maybe had second thoughts later on and began to resist, but it was too late. You had unleashed the machine. But what I'm getting at is I think it's been such tremendous overkill. And now with Biden coming in and the real crazies, joining his administration, Fauci, I guess, is going to head the medical advice. He'll be the moderate, I think. But in any event, I think it's creating a tremendous negative reaction at the grassroots level. And finally, maybe people are going to see that there's a difference between government and society, that liberty is something that's precious and needs to be defended. And it's being run roughshod by a government that has taken on a mission stopping the spread of a highly transmissible virus that can't be stopped, and that what we need to focus on is protecting the 5%, not locking down or imprisoning the 95% of the population that either is not even going to be infected or will manage the disease through the better and better treatments that are coming out. Now, you and I, Tom, have talked about this a lot, and I try to keep updated as these numbers come in, and the mainstream media and CNN keeps running their, what I call a chyron of death across the screen, number of cases, number of deaths, and so forth. But here's where we are as of a couple of days ago. For the population in America, young people under 15, there's 61 million of them. The fatality rate from COVID, even as broadly and expansively as they measure it, is 0.2 person per 100,000. Okay. And if we take the 15 to 24 year old population, I call that kind of the social congregating, the people that go to the bars and games and gyms and all the rest of it, there's 43 million of them. The fatality rate, even broadly defined, is 1 per 100,000. If we go to the other end of the spectrum, the 85 and over, where the vulnerable population really lies, there's 6.5 million Americans in that category. The fatality rate, unfortunately, has been 1,650 per 100,000 as of a few days ago. So the point I'm making is that the ratio between the great-grandparents' generation, as I call it, and the school kids' generation under 15 and under is 9,200 to 1. So what in the hell are we doing? Shutting down the economy, shutting down social life, putting all of these restraints on people, including now Biden's mandatory mask wearing, when it's very clear that the virus is not some kind of bubonic plague that's a lethal threat to everyone, but in a sense is a bully that picks on the elderly and infirm, and policy ought to be directed to them, not to wrecking the economy. Well, we know all this, but that's just kind of an update on where we are. My point is, I think people like in your audience last night are beginning to recognize the overkill, the lies that this has been a gigantic government orchestrated scam. And there should be an opening for some politicians who understand things like Rand Paul. I'm really counting on more and more as I see how brilliant he is and how comprehending he is of these issues, to go to the public and say, liberty is important, and this is what I stand for, and I hope he runs for president, to tell you the truth, and tries to form either a new party or a new coalition within the Republican Party around him, because it's getting late in the hour. If something doesn't change dramatically soon, we're going to drift into, a status dystopia that we can't ever get out of.
I want to share with you, David, a few items from the news that confirm our suspicion that after Biden was elected, that things would change in terms of the way the virus was portrayed. Now, there were two theories. One would be that they would become even more unreasonable because now they're in charge and they can impose whatever they want. But then the other theory was, all right, by the time the midterms come around, if everybody is still socially distanced, it's going to be a little hard for Biden to say, I used the science and I directed us out of this. So here's what I've got. This is a friend of mine who compiled these. So we've heard Governor Cuomo saying we have to reopen, otherwise there'll be nothing left to reopen. So we have that. We have Chicago, the mayor of Chicago, saying bars and restaurants need to be opened as soon as possible, and now punishing union teachers for not returning to in-person teaching. We have the sudden easing of restrictions in Massachusetts. We have reopening of bars and restaurants in D.C. We have the so-called Republican governor in Maryland suddenly saying they need to reopen schools, the cycle threshold for testing suddenly lowered in Kansas. And then, of course, we saw that thing from the World Health Organization saying you need to lower the PCR cycle threshold. They've taken that down since then, but don't worry, we all captured it. NPR, here's one headline from January 19th. As death rate accelerates, U.S. records 400,000 lives lost to the coronavirus. Here's January 21st, the day after the inauguration. Current deadly U.S. coronavirus surge has peaked, researchers say. I mean, you can't make this up. The Journal of the American Journal of Medicine just published an article, paper from August, but they just published it, now having positive things to say about hydroxychloroquine. I mean, it's unbelievable at this point, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, I would just add to your list the one I saw 2 days ago. Remember the New York Times piece that was totally out of step in late August when they went through the PCR tests, the CTs, the cycle thresholds in Massachusetts and New York? They had the data analyzed and it showed, you know, anywhere from 60 to 90% of the positives were at such high CT thresholds that they were false positives. They were fragments of leftover RNA. They weren't going to make anybody sick and they weren't going to make anybody contagious. Now, that was kind of an accident when the Times reporter put it out and it got, you know, ignored entirely by the rest of the MSM. But all of a sudden, I think January 17th, I think is the date, they republished it with an update that reiterated the same theme with even more compelling data. So, yeah, there are, you know, there are signs that maybe some sanity is beginning to reemerge, but they're still going to keep us locked up for a good while, notwithstanding some of these positive developments. But that gets to the larger issue, though, and that is, we have had, you know, a total eruption of fiscal insanity in response to this, and that is still going full steam. Biden came in with his $1.9 trillion plan before he even was actually sworn in. I, the other day, wrote about this. I set that side by side with the first four bailouts. I call them everything bailouts. Remember the families first, and then there was the CARES Act, and then there was the triple P extension. But anyway, there was $4 trillion in place as of the end of December of various kinds of COVID relief and everything bailouts. Biden adds another $1.9 trillion. So let's call it rounded $6 trillion of solution to the problem of an economy that was hit unnecessarily, but hit hard by the lockdowns, not the virus itself, not the pathogen, you know, in people's bodies, but the pathogen in the government agencies that led to what I call lockdown nation. But in any event, what I did was to go back and say, can we define in some reasonable rough way the magnitude of the loss or the problem that's being addressed with $6 trillion worth of, you know, stimmy checks and extended unemployment and payroll protection program for small business and so forth. And I came up with three numbers, and these can't be disputed. I looked at February, which was pre-COVID, before anybody really understood what was happening, as a benchmark for where the economy was. Of course, Trump then said it was the greatest economy in the world. That wasn't exactly true, but the economy was at a pretty high peak. And I measured then the loss of wage and salary income per month compared to the February level, which was $805 billion a month. And what I came up with is that there was a big loss in April and May, but as we got towards the end of the year, the loss basically has gotten into rounding errors. But for the full year, those 10 months, March through December, the loss of wage and salary income, and you know, these are Commerce Department numbers, they're not the end all and be all of accuracy, but it's pretty decent, was less than $300 billion. It was $276 billion. Let's call it $300 billion. So in the best light of this, you put out $6 trillion worth of bailouts, borrowed all the money, and then the Fed monetized all the debt, or you will be putting out $6 trillion, in order to address a $300 billion problem. That's 22 times overkill, for crying out loud. So that was the first measure I used. Then I said, well, you know, they're saying it's not just the loss of wages and salaries, as if the government's responsible for indemnifying everyone hurt by its own stupidity. That's another whole issue that we can get into. But in any event, they're throwing in a lot of, you know, they in the five measures that we're talking about here, there's more than $2 trillion that has gone into the payroll protection plan and other small business and business aid, including, you know, the bailouts for the airlines and a few other targeted industries. So what I measured was the total loss of non-financial business value added. That's the day-to-day economy. That's everything from A to Z, other than banks who don't really create a lot of value. And if you look at the total loss in the non-financial business economy, again, over the 10 months, using the same technique of starting with the February benchmark, the loss has been $600 billion. So, you know, we put out 10 times more bailout dollars, $6 trillion, than the loss of total business activity over the 10 months. And then finally, I looked at GDP. As flaky as parts of that are, the loss has been $800 billion. And again, it's been hit with a $6 trillion bazooka, you know, or eight times more. Now, obviously, the problem is the $6 trillion isn't going to go away. It's going to be on the Uncle Sam's balance sheet from until time immemorial. We're going to be paying debt service on it every year. And it went to, you know, address a problem that was a fraction of that size and shouldn't have happened for the most part anyway, had we not gone into lockdown. So, you know, I think we're in a pretty big mess here. And even if some rationality is starting to break through in unexpected places like the New York Times and the governor's office in Albany, I think we're deep in the soup, and there's going to be a lot of long-term repercussions from all of this.
I hadn't thought of any of this till I read your article about it, that I just assumed, you know, everybody is suffering, and I don't favor these stimulus things, but I assumed that there was at least some kind of rationale behind them.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the real problem here is that there's no real way to deal in aggregates with this. Like, there obviously the pain is being felt by very specific sectors and very specific people. It's not a generic pain. There are plenty of people who just continued to work as before.
Right. And as a matter of fact, you know, for all of their crocodile tears about the lower classes and the working class and the near poor, which comes from Democrats generally, but frankly, Washington overall, there's a lot of Republicans that mouth the same thing. But nevertheless, when Fauci and that crowd decided that the epicenter of the transmission was gyms that young people go to and restaurants and bars and movie theaters and other kinds of public event and sports arenas and so forth, they brought the hammer down on the bottom of the labor market wage scale. There was overwhelming loss of jobs in, you know, what's called the hospitality and entertainment sector. There used to be 17 million jobs before the thing hit in February. At one point, it was down to 8 million. So, you know, more than half of the people lost their jobs. But these jobs are, for the most part, barely minimum wage or above. They get 25, 30 hours a week. They're not full-time jobs. They generate, if you stick with it for a full year at those kinds of wage rates and hours, less than $20,000 a year. That's who's been hit by this. People at the top of the scale that could function in the Zoom economy or just in the normal economy haven't lost any income at all. And that's why I object so strenuously to these so-called STEMI checks, which, you know, were in the original CARES Act last March, and then they topped it up again in December, and now, you know, with the $600, and now Biden's coming back to finish it off with $1,400, you know, per capita to make it $2,000. Overall, there's been, you know, more than $1 trillion allocated to these STEMI checks that aren't even means tested, really. I mean, they say if you're above $200,000 in, you know, a married couple income, you finally lose your STEMI check dollars. But, you know, that's 90% of the households in America and of taxpayers are eligible for these STEMI checks, when the overwhelming bulk of them haven't been laid off or unemployed or even lost any income. And some of them have gained a fair amount of wealth because they've been speculating in this totally bloated stock market. So what kind of, you know, just insanity is this? I can see maybe trying to top up unemployment insurance a little bit, because some states pay you know, less than 40 or 50% of wages on a replacement basis. And there are some, like, part-time workers and so-called gig workers who aren't covered by most state programs. So my point is, you could have put in a few hundred billion dollars into the existing unemployment insurance system targeted to the actual people that were unfortunately thrown in the snow by these stupid lockdowns. And that would have solved the problem. You didn't need the STEMI checks. You didn't need, frankly, you can't justify all these handouts to small business because they're supposedly only to keep their payrolls going. It's just another way of dealing with unemployment. But they didn't do that. They just went, they jumped the shark, so to speak, on spending and stimulus and bailouts and indemnifications that were just crazy. And this is one of the lasting impacts of this. I mean, Washington got so caught up in this so-called crisis, and now you have Biden saying we're on a war footing. And every time the government has a war, a poverty war, or a war on drugs, or a war on a virus, you better hang on to your wallet, because you know what they're going to do. They've lost any sense of fiscal limits. And it's been both parties bellying up to the bar. And I wonder how we're going to get back to something that's, you know, even minimally normal, how we're going to get back to something that's called vague fiscal discipline after this orgy. And it's really a bacchanalia of spending and borrowing.
Hey, folks, we interrupt this tale of federal foolishness to thank our sponsor, the official coffee of the Tom Woods Show, Press House Coffee, the coffee that made the old man here into a coffee drinker. I start my day off with a satisfied smile on my face thanks to this coffee. If you like traditional diner-style coffee, you're going to get the best cup you've ever had from Press House. But if you're more adventurous, like the old man here, then you're going to want to try, in particular, my two favorites, the blueberry muffin and the key lime pie. And you say, Woods, I don't want coffee with those flavors. Oh, yes, you do. I'm ordering you to try them because they're delicious and they're going to make your life better. And they don't make them taste that way by spraying some awful chemical on them. They blend real coffees together to produce this amazing result. Every bag is roasted to order, ground any way you'd like, and shipped to you within 72 hours for peak freshness. We'll take 20% off your first order and get a chance to win a year of free coffee by using promo code WOODS at PressHouseCoffee.com. That's 20% off your first order and a chance to win a year of free coffee when you use promo code WOODS at PressHouseCoffee.com. Can I ask you a question? One of my supporters, I do a live stream for some of the folks who support the show every month. And somebody asked me, why in this crazy environment would bond yields be rising? Do you have any insights into that?
Yeah, of course, when you say rising, it's all a relative matter. They were insane when the 10-year bond last August touched around 0.5%. It was actually 49 basis points. At a time when the honest measure of inflation is running 2% on a year-over-year basis. It was just economically ludicrous to have the benchmark security of the entire global financial system. Remember, everything prices off the 10-year, the yield curve on the government debt does, and then all of the GSE debt that's priced from that, and all the corporate debt that's priced from the government debt. And then ultimately, those drive PE rate multiples, and that drives the stock market. So the entire global financial system is driven at bottom by the yield on the 10-year, and it was at 50 basis points or 150 basis points underwater in a 2% inflation world. So now we've gone back to 110, 115, I'm not sure what it is exactly at the moment, and they say the bond yield has gone up. No, it's just kind of rebounded a tiny amount in the direction of sanity. And I think the reason that it's happening is the government is now borrowing so much money, the market is losing confidence a little bit that the Fed can keep monetizing all of that debt that's flowing out of the U.S. Treasury because, you know, supply and demand sooner or later drives yield. Price discovery has been destroyed, but to the extent that the Fed can't keep up with this flow of debt, you know, it's a tsunami, then obviously the market's going to clear at a somewhat higher yield. But beyond that, I think what you ought to really take from that is not that yields are going up to 110 basis points, 1.1%, but that number, even today, is reflective of a gigantic bubble in the global bond market. All yields are way too low. All bonds are priced way too high as a result of this massive bond buying spree of not just the Fed, but all the central banks. We know that the Fed is still buying $120 billion of Treasury and GSE paper a month. The ECB is doing $130 billion. So between them, that's a quarter of a trillion a month. You know, it's billions per day. And then if you throw in a few other central banks around the world that are equally crazy, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, and Bank of England and Canada and others, the central banks are probably pumping, you know, $500 to $700 billion into the bond market every month. That's totally distorting or mispricing bonds. That's why you've got something like $18 trillion of bonds trading at negative nominal yields, and all bonds trading at negative real yields. So that's a $90 trillion market worldwide, sovereign, corporate, and business real estate tradable debt bonds. And it's a massive bubble. One of these days, the central banks are going to run out of either willpower or sanity. They might become infected with a tad of sanity, and they're going to have to stop monetizing all this debt. And when they do, there'll be a traumatic, violent repricing of this vastly overvalued bond market. And then, you know, we'll really be off to the races.
Well, as we wrap up here, I'm going to open a can of worms, because why not? You've got a piece up for your subscribers, David Stockman's ContraCorner.com, Orange Man Gone. And I think, you know, at some point, it would be interesting to do a more detailed retrospective looking back on the past 4 years, because there's almost nobody I can trust to do it. The left doesn't understand the real problems with Trump, and they're living in some kind of delusional alternate reality anyway, where Russiagate was the big problem and this and that. Right. And then the neocons, their opinions are worth zero to me. And so I think you have more or less hit it on the head. You said that you start off by saying, this guy has enemies that really would make people like us envious. He's got all the right people against him. In that way, he's very much like Nixon, who had, you know, in a way, all the right enemies, except Trump times 100 compared to that. And in another way, like Nixon, when you actually look at his own record, you think, well, geez, he went to all that trouble accumulating all those enemies, and that's what he has to show for himself, right?
Yeah, that was exactly my point. And frankly, I'm going to do a series on this. I just launched it yesterday in the piece that I put out, but I'm going to write a 4 or 5 part series, and I'm going to go into the real history of it. In other words, as you just stated, my thesis is, and I'll just say what I wrote, the everlasting irony of Donald J. Trump's presidency is this. He had all the right enemies, but virtually without exception made all the wrong decisions during his hapless 4-year sojourn in the Oval Office. And I had fun then going on with his enemies. And if you'll bear with me, Tom, I'd like to just recite a few more of that because people get a flavor, I think, for where I'm coming from. And what I said is the list of enemies is enough to make any right-thinking supporter of peace, prosperity, and liberty proud. That starts with the TV networks and the print organs of the mainstream stenographers club who peddle the state's propaganda and call it news. This most especially includes the masters of mendacity at CNN, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. It also includes the bipartisan national security mafia, the climate change howlers, the race card handlers, the Russophobes, the neocon war brigades, the NATO, IMF, UN acolytes, the Washington nomenclatura, the careerist racketeers of Capitol Hill, the Beltway shields of the Lincoln Project, the Silicon Valley thought police, and the celebrity scolds of entertainment and media, among others. With so many worthy enemies, it is amazing that he managed to do so little good and so very much wrong. But there is really no mystery to it when you cut to the essence of Donald J. Trump, the POTUS POSUR, as I call it. And that is that Donald was a principle-free Caesarian nationalist, Caesar, whose overriding objective was his own personal power and glorification. His route thereto was inflaming a superficial nationalism that allowed him to pose as the defender of the flag, the military, the borders, guns, domestic jobs, policemen and firemen, law and order, religion, middle-class probity, the right to watch politics-free football games, and above all, to stand tall in the face of foreign malefactors and plunderers of American wealth. And, you know, then I go on to say, let's sort all this out and see what actually happened and what he actually accomplished. That's what we're going to be doing in the next few days. And, you know, let the chips fall where they may.
Well, indeed. I want to recommend that people check out David Stockman's ContraCorner.com because you'll get detailed analysis, not just about the economy, but about politics from somebody who's been there. I mean, you've been in public life, but also in the private sector with accumulated knowledge that would require four brains to contain it all. So it's very, very much worth every penny over at davidstockmanscontracorner.com. I'm going to link to that. That's a rather a mouthful. So I'm going to link to that at tomwoods.com/1822, our show notes page for today. Well, David, it would be wonderful if you came down my neck of the woods because everything's great down here. The water's fine, as they say.
All right. Well, we'll do that. And great to talk to you again. And this is an ongoing saga. We're in uncharted waters. So I think the best thing we can do is try to be alert, understand what's happening, put it in the context of history, ignore all the filters that the mainstream media wants us to use, and look at what really stands in front of us.
All right. Thanks again, David.
Okay. Very good.
All right, folks, before you go, I have to make an amendment to the announcement that I made yesterday. Yesterday, I announced that the 2000th Tom Woods Show episode is coming up this year and that I'm going to have a live event as we record that episode together. It'll be a probably 2.5-hour event. Won't cost you a thing to attend. It's going to be October 16th in Orlando. The modification is I mentioned that there's going to be a reception for my supporting listeners, but I'm upping the ante here. I'm going to have a dinner for everybody, which we did do last time, and I swore I would never do again, but I changed my mind. We're going to have a dinner for everybody who supports the show through the Supporting Listeners program. And I think for the, let's say, for the platinums and up, I'll have a super special pre-dinner reception in the hospitality suite. So this will be for the elite of the elite. So I want you all to know, no matter what your level is, you're getting a free dinner from Old Woods here if you support the Tom Woods Show through the Supporting Listeners program. The website to join that program, of course, is supportinglisteners.com. Anybody can get into the general event itself, but the dinner is just for the supporting listeners, and nobody is paying a dime except the old man here. This is on me as a gift to you for supporting the show. You get the dinner, the special pre-show time we'll spend together, and then the event itself is a gift to all you listeners. It's not cheap to put on an event like this. Let's just say whatever you think it costs, it's 10 times more than that. But it's only at once every 4 years, and we all love it, and it energizes us. And I'm convinced it's the right thing to do, and I just love doing it. So doggone it, we're going to do it. So stay tuned for details. I'll tell you the exact location and how to register. It doesn't cost you anything to get in, but for planning purposes, it would help me if I had a handle on the numbers. So I am going to ask people to register. So stay tuned, listen in here. Of course, subscribe to my newsletter. That's how you'll be absolutely certain you won't miss the announcement about that. And you can get on that and at the same time get my Corona resource list at tomwoods.com/corona. That's where you can sign up for my list, but also I send you as a gift a PDF that I made for some state legislators telling them these are the sources you should consult if you want to know what's really going on with the virus. So tomwoods.com/corona, get on that list. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.